in the last 30 years or so. And I'm going to spend some time this morning trying to give you a little bit of a flavor of the thinking process, the logic, if it was any, behind the development of the concepts dealing with this type of compound. And then we'll start talking about the individual pharmacology of the opioids. As I think it's where we were at the end of the hour on Wednesday, I was suggesting to you that pain is a sensory modality, much like temperature or pressure, hot or cold, taste or touch. It's a sensory modality. And as we started learning about that whole concept, we said, if it's a sensory modality, there must be such a thing as a pain sensor. A sensory modality must have an affective meaning going from the periphery to the CNS, an affective nerve tract. Much like taste or touch or pressure or whatever, sensory receptor for pain. We found it. Pain receptors. Okay? If there are pain receptors, there must be something that gets the message from the pain receptor to the CNS. Well, you figure that out. Okay? Nerve tracts. If there are nerve tracts, there must be synapses. And if there are synapses, there must be a neurotransmitter at those synapses. Am I kind of going too fast for you here? Okay. No. Good. If there is a neurotransmitter, then we know that for a number of neurotransmitters, we have the ability to block that neurotransmitter. That is an inhibitor that has good, maybe excellent affinity. And how much intrinsic activity? Zero. We can block the pain. That's where we are in probably 1960. And much like when I talked about movement with Parkinson's disease, we discovered that there are not one, but probably two different afferent pathways for pain. Where are we here? There we are. One of them, in terms of animal development, evolution, use that naughty E word, starts developing earlier in the development of animals. It's on the left. It is known as the paleospinal thalamic pathway. And it is much more concerned with thoracolumbar and abdominal areas, and transmits dull, achy, visceral types of pain, whereas the newer pathway, which we can hopefully learn real quick, because after all, what does the prefix neo mean? New. The new pathway, the neospinal thalamic, and by the way, remember back when we started this whole discussion, spinal thalamic says it starts in the spine and goes to the, which is kind of a lie because most of them end up in the cortex, in the cerebrum, but at least they go through the thalamus. Spinal thalamic pathway. The newer one, as you see on the handout, is much more concerned with musculoskeletal issues, sharp pain, sprains and strains and all that kind of good stuff. Okay? And as we start looking into these two pathways, we discover, yes, Matilda, they both go through the thalamus. The one goes through the thalamus. The neo goes to the thalamus and then goes directly to the cerebral cortex where it's registered as pain. But interestingly enough, the older pathway, before it hits the thalamus, hits the hypothalamus and has some corollaries that run in and around not only the hypothalamus but the midbrain. Okay, particularly the periaqueductal gray matter of the midbrain. And then it, before it gets to the cerebral cortex, makes a detour through the limbic system. Okay? Now, where do we see synapses and the opportunity for something to occur? There is an area known as substantia gelatinosa in the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. This is synapse number uno for most pain afferent impulses. As they come in from the pain receptor, this is where they have their first synaptic connection at the level of the spinal cord. In addition, we see a synapse and an opportunity to interfere in the reticular formation of the mesencephalon in an area known as periaqueductal gray matter. And of course, periaqueductal says it's right around the aqueduct. It's right around the center. It's inside of the reticular activating system. And then we see pain receptors in the thalamus, or pain synapses. We see pain synapses in the limbic system, at least as far as the paleo pathway is concerned. And of particular note here is the amygdala as part of the limbic and area. So we have these pain receptors, okay? And the natural thought was that if there are these, if you will, synapses, there are transmitters, and what we are doing with opioid compounds is we are blocking one or more of these synapses. That was the initial thought. I mean, that's kind of the logical thought that I gave you before. So let's get away from this for a second, because after all, I'm going to say it. Here's the issue. I'm going to take it a little detour here. Here's the issue. Animal models of pain, much like animal models of epilepsy, pretty difficult to develop. You don't go to a guinea pig and say, "Are you in pain?" and expect to get a straight answer. Guinea pigs are notorious liars. You can't do it. So what animal model do you have? Humans. And basically, we didn't have the ability to measure pain. Like we can measure height or weight, we can't measure pain. So how do we do it? We have these neat descriptors. Are you in excruciating pain, mild pain, pain, severe pain? Depends on the investigator what kind of stupid adjectives they want to use. But that's how, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, rate your pain. 15. No, you've got to stay within 1 and 10. You've got all these kinds of variables. Very difficult. Okay? So, and you say, well, can I open up your spinal cord and measure the pain? No, you can't, damn it. I won't let you. All right? So we kind of come in through the back door because we discover that these opioid compounds, we knew it. We didn't know kind of why, but we knew it, that these opioid compounds have a number of other pharmacologic effects besides pain relief. And the reason that they do is that there are a number of similar compounds to what I'm going to describe in a few minutes in the periphery that they do opioid types of things, that similar types of receptors to the pain relief opioid receptors. And when we discovered this peripheral type of activity, that gave us kind of an in to come in through the back door. The big thing is guinea pigs and guinea pig intestine in particular. Guinea pig intestine is rich in opioid receptors. And so we started looking at these opioid compounds on guinea pig intestine and found that instead of being antagonists, that is blocking agents, they were in fact agonists. Remember what the definition of opioid is? Hello? This is last Wednesday. Hello? We changed it. Has agonist activity at one or more of the various opioid receptors? What's the key word there? Agonist. These things are agonists. So if they're agonists, what does that do to our whole theory of how these things are acting? It throws it right out the window. Because we said, well, these are probably acting as blocking agents, antagonists. No, the naturally occurring scheme of things is for the compounds to act as agonists. Okay, so if they act as agonists, then what are we doing? And what we discovered in about 76 to 78, so we're talking only 30 years ago, which is fairly recent, is that, in fact, opioids are not primary neurotransmitters, but in fact are a prime secondary neurotransmitter from a particular type of interneuron. And with the interneuronal idea starting to become established more and more as we develop the mechanisms, the ability to penetrate more and more into the CNS with machines without having to actually cut into it, things like MRI and all that kind of stuff, we discovered, yes, these nerve tracts, particularly the paleospinal thalamic, have a lot of interneuronal connections, a lot of things impinging on this primary pathway to modify it both up and down. And the major down modifier, the major IPSP producer, the major let's stabilize the system was in fact opioid type of compound. And that compound, we discover, is a pentapeptide, and it becomes called, boy, there's we term it encephalin in the brain, because we discover a lot of other, and I'm assuming, I know she used to, Dr. Lovstead is going to talk to you a lot about concepts like endorphins and dimorphins, peripheral types of compounds that have opioid types of activity, precursors in that, but what's in the central nervous system is basically, as a neurotransmitter, is a pentapeptide. Trust me, the central nervous system is very low to make 98, 100, 150 amino acid compounds just to be a goddamn neurotransmitter. We want small and quick acetylcholine, norepinephrine. We don't want some kind of big thing. You know, a small thing will do. And in fact, it's a pentapeptide in Keflin. And to some degree, it's species-specific. To some degree, it's tissue-specific. But there are two major ones that we know of. They differ only by one amino acid, so they kind of subname based on that one amino acid difference is either leucine or lumen-Keflin or methionine metan-Keflin. Pentapeptide, fairly easily made, and this is a neurotransmitter. It is a neurotransmitter that almost universally, when it hits its post-synaptic membrane, that produces an IESP, a stabilization. And so while pain is not blocked, quote-unquote, in the classic sense of high-affinity, non-intrinsic activity, it is blocked in the newer sense of inhibition, IESP creation. So pain is modified in a number of impulses that are coming through this main synapse along the pain afferent pathway will tend to become less. And in fact, since, you know, the mid-70s, we actually have experiments where people have put electrodes down in your leg. Maybe I should do this just to make sure we're understanding. They put electrodes down in here, and then they put another set of electrodes up in here, okay? Twist your arm behind your back, count the number of impulses out there, load you up with morphine, and yeah, Matilda, there are a lot less impulses up higher in the brain for what there is up in the periphery. We are, in fact, modified through generation of IESP, the number of impulses coming in. Okay? And as I suggested, hopefully last Wednesday, while we can modify the number of impulses, there is, if you will, a spinal component to pain relief, saying we are, in fact, modifying here and modifying here. The biggest number of these interneurons, the biggest number of these little interconnectors occur up in the thalamus and in the limbic area of the paleospinal thalamic pathway. So we can get pain relief on the meal pathway, but we're much more effective with this particular mechanism for the paleo. And as I suggested, we tend to be much, these compounds, it's not that they don't provide any pain relief for sprains and strains, it's just that they are much more effective at modifying that paleospinal thalamic pathway, particularly the amygdala, the affective component, the, hey, how do we react to the pain component? Mind over matter. As I suggested, some of us tend to be, and this, I don't mean these terms to be gender specific, because it isn't that way, trust me. Some are macho, some are wusses. Just the normal curve of how much of those inner neurons you've got. Okay? I happen to be blessed or cursed, if you will, with the macho end of the scale. My dad was a foreman in the heat metal treating plant. Okay? One day, one of the electrical boxes started having trouble, so he got up on a 10-foot ladder to fix it, and it blew up in his face. He ended up having skin grafts on the left side of his neck and his arm and all that stuff. But the point of the story is, instead of, well, he's kind of blown off the ladder, but instead of going to the hospital immediately, he fixed the box and went to the hospital 2 hours later. In like manner, probably now 5 or 6 years ago, I was taking my oldest daughter. She was heading back to St. Louis to school, and she was taking the bus, so I ran her down to Grand Rapids for an 8 o'clock bus, 7:50-something. Got down there, we were in a hurry, got everything out of the car, got it loaded on the bus, found out I locked my keys inside the car. I had a 10 o'clock lecture, so I said, well, geez, I got to get back. So what I did was I borrowed somebody's tire iron and I broke out a back window in the car. While I was doing that, I managed to put a pretty good gash in my forearm. It eventually required 20 stitches. But before I did that, I drove back and delivered the lecture. Then I went to the hospital. Okay, remember about 2 weeks ago? You know, sometimes it has its downside, too. You think you're a super person. Do I look like a super person? No, no. But, you know, I can take a lot of pain without, you know, sometimes I break in. 10 years ago, I had a hip replacement. And made a mess up as they were pounding the stake into my left hip. I got what's known as a green stick fracture. The bone just went out like this. So you look at my left hip actually now, and I'm all wired together with my pain and my bones. Don't get sick. All sorts of stuff, okay? But, you know, you deal with it. Yeah, it's painful, but you deal with it. So anyhow, sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. You understand that that's kind of a normal thing. And all I'm saying is that we have this normal curve, because then we start saying, well, what the heck is this all about with these inner neurons and IPSP? And in fact, it suggests that we have a normal modifier of pain that can be liberated mind over matter. That can be generated, if you will, as an IPSP. Enkephalin, then, is a naturally occurring narcotic. And in fact, experiments have been done now to suggest that the whole idea, at least of opioid that is narcotic addiction, is all about, okay, I'm in pain for whatever reason. Or maybe I just want to have a good time with the morphine, I don't know. So I take some doses and I provide exogenous. Morphine must look like this pentapeptide. I produce exogenous compound to produce more IPSPs. You know what the body does as soon as that starts happening? It says, screw it. Why should I make this pentapeptide if you're going to spend the money and provide exogenous compound? So what happens to the amount of enkephalin that we see? Decreases. Now what do you need to get the pain relief? More we start developing what's known as a pharmacodynamic tolerance. And it's not so much that the receptors are more tolerant, it's that the whole system is more tolerant. And so you keep having to apply more and more exogenous because we're making less and less endogenous. But the point of the story is, okay, now we say no more exogenous. The problem then becomes you don't have any endogenous. You've got to restart, refire that whole pentapeptide-making process. And during that 72 hours, whatever, where that whole process kicks back in, what do you go through? Withdrawal. That's now what's thought to be the whole concept behind withdrawal. Is that during that 72 hours, not only do you have less of the endogenous enkephalin, but those receptors become super sensitive. They're looking for that relief. Those IPSPs that you regenerate. So that's a big thing. The other interesting thing, and I've got to do this commercial now since my daughter is now in her third year of acupuncture school, is that a group at the University of Toronto has shown that good acupuncturists will, in fact, increase the number of IPSPs that are generated across these interneurons. That is, more enkephalin types of things will be produced. In like manner, and something that's come down the pike pretty much in the last 10 to 12 years, a lot of the time for intractable types of pain now, one of the things that we do is we put a couple of electrodes in the spine, okay? We run them out of the skin, or no, we run them generally under the skin, around to the front, kind of between the breasts of a female, over the breastbone of a male, bring the electrodes out, okay, pretty much have to be wearing, a button-up shirt or blouse, and a pocket, and what's in the pocket? Electrical transmitter. And you're going to go into pain, what do? Dial up some electricity, fire up that nerve tract, that is responsible for modification, that inhibitory nerve tract that ends up releasing more enkephalin and get pain relief. Okay. So it's there and available to us either naturally or with some modification. Well, one of the popular ways we have now of dealing with pain is in fact exogenous application of chemical to provide for this stabilization, this IPSP here, to say we're going to have less sensory pain sensation coming along the pain nerve tract, whether it be neo or paleospinal foramen. So with that said then, let's start looking a little bit at the pharmacology of these compounds. And the compound that we use is one of our oldest known compounds. And that is, in fact, morphine. Again, without trying to belabor the point, morphine acts as an agonist at various types of opioid receptors. Now, when we discovered this, we did not realize just how many different types of receptors we were talking about. We, at that time, thought there was only one. We now realize that was rather simplistic. But it is an agonist at these various types of receptors. Now, just to put in perspective, I taught in drug action, that was a course you had last year, about the fact that the advent of medicinal chemistry is generally traced to the year 1806. Friedrich Sehr-Turner isolates morphine from opium poppies, papaver somniferum. Remember I talked about the benzoisoquinoline drug papaverin, the first that we really described, but the first one isolated was morphine from opium. So we've got over 200 years now of understanding that the chemical substance, the pure substance, is morphine, the prototype. We've all said, let's try and make something that's as good as morphine without a lot of baggage. So what is the pharmacology of morphine? Well, let me state that while I'm going to talk about the CNS first, the first thing about opium, the first way in which opium was utilized therapeutically, and which maybe we'll be able to talk about by the end of the hour, was as an anti-diarrheal. Constipated. Anti-diarrheal. We'll talk about that in a second. So that's where we first knew about opium. In fact, a popular anti-diarrheal for kids when I was a pharmacist was called tincture of opium. Opium tincture. Okay. So used even up into the mid-70s as an anti-diarrhea. Very popular. All right. Enough said on that. Let's talk about morphine's pharmacology. See if we can get through most of it before the end of the hour. CNS. After all, that's where we're going to try and use it therapeutically. I go through four major points, either in presence or absence of pain. I hope I'm not being too snide, too cynical here. In the presence of pain, what's the major effect? Analgesia. In the absence of pain, what's the major effect? It's not analgesia. To get analgesia, what do you first have to have? Analgesia. Got that? So the major effect in the presence of pain is analgesia. And what's nice, I guess, is that a good word? Nice is that you do it with minimal alteration of consciousness. That is, you can get substantial pain relief without knocking a person into sedation or even chronic hypnosis. Yes, Matilda, I could use a barbiturate to relieve your pain. Or an anesthetic. But in order to get substantial pain relief, what are you going to look like? First of all, you're going to be in that position, probably. You're going to have your eyes shut and you're going to be snoring. Okay, that's the idea. Pain relief is substantial with minimal alteration of consciousness. Secondly, guess what comes along with the pain relief? Euphoria. And by the way, remember when I say pain relief, most of the time, particularly with visceral types of pain, it's not so much the relief of pain as the modification of what it is you're feeling, right? It's not described so much as pain. On a scale of 8 to 10, what's your pain? Well, it's only a 4 instead of an 8. Well, what is it? Well, it's like a warmth or a tingling or something out of the scripture, or pain's down, but we've got something else going on. But euphoria, the lack of pain, produces a consequent, hey, life is great. Okay? Type of thing. So that's the second. Euphoria, a feeling of well-being, a feeling of being better. Third, nausea and vomiting is a major CNS effect. And it's something that, matter of fact, I had to deal with in the last week. Some people called me up. Morphine and similar compounds are stimulants, agonists, that is, there are opioid receptors on what we call the CTZ, the chemoreceptor trigger zone. Some compounds are worse than others in terms of the stimulation. One of the real bad ones for a lot of people is a tablet called Vicodin, which we'll talk about. That's the one I had to deal with a week ago. Vicodin, or morphine, stimulate the chemoreceptor trigger zone. And it's a trigger zone of what? The vomiting center. This is what phenothiazines depress. Morphine is not acting on a dopaminergic receptor here. It's acting on an opioid receptor and a heparin receptor. So phenothiazines tend to be not so good as anti-nauseants here, but to the point, chemoreceptor triggers on stimulation. The interesting thing is, this tends to occur at relatively low blood levels. That is, most of the opioid compounds will do the stimulating as blood levels start going up. But at higher blood levels, at what we would say are analgesic or therapeutic blood levels, we see a depression that is a blockade, that is, the vomiting center is negatively impacted. So, if we can get through the initial nausea and vomiting, we can get to a point where I don't care if the morphine is stimulating the chemoreceptor trigger zone, because no matter how much that's being stimulated, what have I done? I blocked vomiting. So generally, if an opioid is going to produce nausea and vomiting, particularly the vomiting, the emetic episode, it's going to be on the first or maybe the first and second dose. The problem is people vomit and they say, God, I can't handle this medication. What do? They stop it, and then they say, God, I'm in pain, and then they start it again, you know, and you get this vicious yin and yang. If you can get through the first couple of doses, you do better. And it tends to be more prominent in ambulatory types of situations. Even though it's a stimulation of chemoreceptor trigger zone, which doesn't have a whole lot to do with labyrinth apparatus and that kind of thing, if you try and get ambulatory walk around, it tends to be a little worse. So one of the things you can suggest is, hey, lay down for 8 hours or whatever two doses are and see if that won't work for you. You can't get to the point where you no longer feel nauseous. So that's point number three. You get nausea and vomiting. And while consciousness alteration is not usually negatively impacted, number four, in the presence of pain, tends to be a, in the books they'll give you different terminology here, the one I tend to like is mental clouding. You're just not quite as quick cognitively. You can get 2 plus 2 is 4, but it may not come quite as quickly. You can solve the Sudoku or the crossword puzzle, but it's going to take you a couple of minutes longer. And no, I don't accept Dr. Holt. I need more time on the fecal exam because I just had 3 doses of morphine this morning. Okay. Clouding or inability to concentrate tends to happen. And so you apply the sticker that says what? Hello, interns. The sticker says what? Do not operate heavy machinery, until you know how this medication is going to affect you. Okay. Generally, unlike the nausea and vomiting piece, this sticks with you. If it's going to happen, you don't say, well, I won't ride for the first dose, but after that, I'm good. Now, in the absence of pain, like I said, number one is not a factor. You don't get analgesia unless you've got analgesia. Okay? So in the absence of pain, we've got to throw something else in. And that is that we will see in people that are not in pain, that take opioids for whatever reason, a decrease in spontaneous motor activity. We have our little tics and habits, don't we? Now that I've got the modesty panels on the front of the desk, I can't look around. But my guess is that a few of you are bobbing your foot under the desk. I see one young lady twirling her hair back here. We have all sorts of little, fiddle with our ears or, how many of you are making Googles or writing Pope as an asshole? We have a little, kind of, those tend to decrease. Okay, spontaneous types of, we're not thinking about it, they just happen, types of motor activities tend to go down. Doesn't necessarily happen in the presence of pain, maybe because the pain has already taken them away. We're so interested in the pain that we don't do it anymore. But if pain is absent, we will definitely see a depression in those. Secondly, most individuals, if I get a normal curve of things, most individuals in the absence of pain and they take an opioid, will become dysphoric. That is, there will be a feeling of unease, a feeling of trepidation. I won't say a bad trip. That's overstating it, but just a general, things aren't quite right. As opposed to if you are in pain, what's the basic thing? Euphoria. Now, that dysphoric reaction can be, like a lot of other things, a normal curve of distribution. And one of the interesting things that we discovered in the last 30 years is that you can suppose the whole class here, it's probably kind of a wild assumption, but suppose as a whole class, you are all virgins in regard to opioid drugs. None of you have ever had one. Codeine, morphine, whatever. And I say, we're all taking a dose of morphine. And then I've got a test, a quiz, or whatever you want to call it, that says, are you dysphoric or euphoric? And I get my normal curve of distribution. The more euphoric, the more less dysphoric you are with your virginal dose, the greater the addictive liability. While most people get dysphoric, there's that small percentage that tend to say, even with the dose of morphine in the absence of pain, this is pretty good stuff. Addictive liability. people that have been addicted to opioids and have been clean, if you will, 5 years or longer, should be all washed out of their system, and you give them a test dose of morphine, guess where they are on that scale of dysphoria to euphoria? Strongly euphoric. Most individuals, again, with absence of pain and a dose of morphine will be dysphoric. 3 and 4, pretty much the same. There will be the nausea, there will be the mental clouding. Okay? Now, as part of the CNS, I want to talk just briefly about hypothalamus and its conjunction with pituitary. We will see some depression of the hypothalamic heat regulatory center. There will be issues in terms of cold exposure. They will be more sensitive to cold. Most opioids tend to increase the release of vasopressin, or what we now call antidiuretic hormone, EDH. What did I say? What did I just say? What is it? Increases antidiuretic hormone, we will tend to see an overgrowth as well. If you know how to build up, you know your anaerobia, but most people, the amount of urine being produced will lessen considerably. That's from the posterior pituitary, we see an increase in APH. Now, what about the anterior pituitary? Okay? Pretty much the opposite. Everything from the anterior pituitary tends to decrease with diminished importance. What are we talking about? The gonadotropins, FSH and LH, go down. Gonadotropins, of course, are responsible for fertility, but more to the point, responsible for libido. So while you're off on a good trip with your recreational opioids, your libido is probably going to suffer dramatically. Okay? A decrease in TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. A decrease in ACTH, adrenal corticotropic hormone. Anterior pituitary hormones tend to decrease. Okay?